Greetings and leukoponic protonesias, my auto-polemically summacious listeners, and welcome to this November 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this lousy, stinking excuse for a science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Let's start off with the Idiot Scientist of the Month Award. The award goes to Dr. Josiah Zahner for using himself to experiment on. Live on Facebook, of all places. First, let's start off with who Zahner is. Josiah Zahner is the founder of Odin. What's Odin? Well, it's a company for biohackers. Quote, "At Odin, we believe the future is going to be dominated by genetic engineering, and consumer genetic design will be a big part of that. We're making that happen by creating kits and tools that allow anyone to make unique and usable organisms at home, in the lab, or anywhere." In other words, Zahner is helping crazies and terrorists to make their dreams come true with inexpensive biotech kits. Thanks, Mr. Zahner, for your love of science and humanity. Zahner started biohacking while he was getting his PhD in molecular biophysics at the University of Chicago. Unfortunately, he seems to be one of the more infamous graduates of my alma mater. Anyway, he first created the chromocord in his apartment, the world's first musical instrument that uses engineered protein I can't even say this. It's the world's first musical instrument that uses engineered protein nanotechnology. Wow, now doesn't that sound useful, folks? Doesn't it? Really? Anyway, what has he done lately? Well, he's decided to kick gene editing into the mainstream. As I have mentioned previously to you guys, CRISPR-Cas is a cheap and easy technique for making precise changes to DNA genomes. And for the last year or two, it's gotten researchers around the world racing to use it in treating a host of human diseases. And yes, I've mentioned it over and over again over the last year or so. But this race is not confined to the lab. Last month, Josiah Zahner became the first person known to edit his own genes with CRISPR. Yes, Zahner became his own guinea pig. During a lecture about human genetic engineering that was streamed live on Facebook, Zahner whipped out a vial and a syringe, and then he injected himself. He injected himself apparently with a myostatin inhibitor in a CRISPR construct. Myostatin normally inhibits muscle growth, so by turning it off, he expects the arm that he injected it into will grow huge and muscular, like those myostatin mutant dogs that you may have seen in news articles. Zahner says, "This is the first time in history that we're no longer slaves to our genetics." Now, following in his footsteps, other biohackers are getting ready to take the plunge and tinker with their own genes. Because if your best friend jumps off a cliff, then you're going to follow him, of course. Especially if your friend is a dyed-in-the-wool idiot. Let's ignore the million different risks, like infection or inducing an autoimmune disease, or, worst-case scenario, inducing neomorphogenesis. That's cancer, folks. Let's just jump over that cliff, like the idiot sheeple that we appear to be. But to Zahner, whether or not the experiment actually works is beside the point. What he's trying to demonstrate, he says, is that cutting-edge biotechnology like CRISPR should be available for people to do as they wish, and not be controlled by academics and pharmaceutical companies who think they know better. He says, "I want to live in a world where people get drunk, and instead of giving themselves tattoos, they're like, 'I'm drunk, I'm going to CRISPR myself.' It sounds crazy, but I think that would be a pretty interesting world to live in, for sure." Yes, and so would a world with killer robots and out-of-control zombies. But no one is cheering for a world like that, are they? Of course, such biotechnology is highly regulated in the US and the UK, but it's not illegal to edit your own DNA, although it's not exactly legal either. It's a gray area right now, according to the USDA, ladies and gentlemen. Worse, unfortunately, it's not clear to what extent, if any, Zayner is responsible for any harm that comes to people who copy him. It's a gray area that the FDA doesn't regulate. The FDA seems to have a lot of gray areas, doesn't it? Although apparently now they're becoming more interested in those gray areas as amateur scientists like idiot Zayner disseminate their experiments and methods and their equipment online. Oh, one last comment on the idiot. Worst thing about Zayner's little stunt is that it will do absolutely nothing for his muscles. Myostatin has most of its inhibitory effects when your muscles are actually growing when you're young. It's just kind of stupid to think that when your muscles are already developed and you're sitting there with mature muscles, that there is anything that you can do to make them bigger and stronger. Oh, that is, unless you're actually exercising. A myostatin inhibitor is not going to suddenly turn you into the Hulk, or Thor, or even Spider-Man. It will likely do nothing, even if it's expressing at full levels in a mature human. Enough. Let's continue the evening with two astronomy stories which do not have scientists trying to commit slow suicide. First, it appears that a lot of assumptions have been made about rocky exoplanets that look like Earth, and it looks like a lot of those assumptions are wrong. Exoplanet astronomer Dr. Vincent van Alen of Leiden University in the Netherlands and his colleagues have just published a study in the October 15th issue of the online journal Archive that says that Earth may not provide the best blueprint for how rocky planets are born. An analysis of planets outside the solar system suggests that most hot, rocky exoplanets actually started out more like gassy Neptunes. Such planets are rocky now because their stars blew their thick atmospheres away, leaving nothing but that final inhospitable core of metal. That could mean these planets are not representative of Earth as scientists thought, and using them to estimate the frequency of potentially life-hosting worlds is kind of misleading. It turns out that one of the big discoveries is that Earth-sized, likely rocky planets are incredibly common, at least on hotter orbits. I think that the big question is, are these hot exoplanets telling us anything about the frequency of Earth-like planets? And that result suggests that they might not be, really. Observations so far suggest that worlds about Earth size probably cluster into two categories, rocky super-Earths and gaseous mini-Neptunes. Super-Earths are between 1 and 1.5 times as wide as Earth, whereas mini-Neptunes are anywhere between 2.5 to 4 times the Earth's size. Earlier work showed that there's a clear gap between those two planet sizes. Because planets that are close to their stars are easier for telescopes to see, most of the rocky super-Earths discovered so far have close-in orbits, with years lasting anywhere between 2 to 100 days, and making the world way too hot to host life as we know it. Because they are rocky like Earth, scientists include those worlds with their cooler brethren when estimating how many habitable planets might be out there. If hot super-Earths start out rocky, maybe it's because the worlds form later than their puffy mini-Neptune companions, when there's less gas left in the growing planetary system to build an atmosphere. Or, maybe, sort of opposite, such planets along with mini-Neptunes may start with thick atmospheres, and those rocky worlds may have had their atmospheres stripped away by the stellar winds, as I said earlier. Van Alen and his colleagues analyzed 117 planets whose host stars' sizes have been measured using astroseismology. That's a technique that tracks how often the star's brightness changes as interior oscillations ripple through it, and it uses that frequency to determine the size of the star. Van Alen says, quote, "Think of stars as musical instruments. A double bass and a violin produce the sound the same way, but the pitch is very different because of the instrument's size. It's the same thing with stars," unquote. The researchers then calculated the planet's size, between 1 and 4 times that of Earth, with about 4 times greater precision than in previous studies. As expected, the planets clustered in groups of around 1.5 to 2.5 times Earth's radius, leaving a gap in the middle. Finally, the team looked at how the planet's sizes changed with distance from the host star. planets that were rocky from the start should be closer to the stars, where studies of other young star systems suggest that there should be less material available when those planets are forming. But if proximity to a star's winds is key, there should be some larger rocky worlds closer in, with smaller gaseous worlds farther out. Van Allen's planets match the second picture. The largest of the rocky planets nestled close to the stars were bigger than the distant ones. So that suggests that the rocky planets once had atmospheres and lost them. Our second astronomy story again points out just how ignorant we are of the universe. We seem to think that we know a lot, but as a matter of fact, that we're pretty dumb as lampposts when it comes to completely understanding the natural world. How ignorant are we? Well, apparently there are zombie supernovas out there. And you may well say, "What you talking about, Willis?" in response to that. Let's respond to that. A dying star was caught mid-nova in September 2014. And that was not the end of it, though. Apparently, it still isn't done dying several years later. It has lasted 10 times longer than any other supernova of its type that anyone has ever seen. Most supernovae brighten once they explode, and then they fade into obscurity. But supernova IPTF14HLS has had at least 5 peaks in brightness since Dr. Iyer Arkavi of the University of California, Santa Barbara, and his colleagues began watching it. This work was just published this month in the journal Nature. Arkavi says, quote, "It refused to go gentle into that good night. It has just kept on exploding and exploding. Evidence of at least one of the star's past explosions comes through in its light, which reveals a shell of material around the star," unquote. The light from IPTF14HLS has a signature identical to common Type 2P supernova, in which a massive star's core collapses and becomes a neutron star, with the resulting shockwave blowing away its hydrogen-rich outer layers. The bright flashes of these types of supernovas last about 100 days before fading away. This supernova, however, seems to be acting a little like a Type 2P in slow motion. After 600 days of exploding, it looks like a Type 2P supernova after only 60 days. It's also radiating several times more energy than any Type 2P supernova that anyone has ever seen. Arkavi and his team are trying to find a mathematical model that fits the star behavior, but nothing has matched up yet. Arkavi seems to think that the most promising model to explain the zombie star is something called pulsational pair instability. And the way he explains it is this. The centers of very large stars, about 95 to 130 times the size of the Sun, can reach over a billion degrees Celsius. At these temperatures, gamma rays in the core make pairs of electrons into their antimatter counterparts. Antimatter electrons are called positrons. Yes, positrons do exist. This is not something made up on Star Trek as a plot explanation. At any rate, the model further proposes that the radiation pressure from gamma rays stops a star from collapsing under gravity. When the rays turn into particles, the star begins to fall in on itself, igniting an explosion that can blow off the star's outer layer, but leave the rest intact to begin the process over again. Arkavi says, quote, "This could account for IPTF14HLS's many explosions and for a possible pre-supernova eruption observed in the same spot in 1954. It would also result in multiple shells of expanding material like the one we've already seen," unquote. But there's a catch. There's always a catch, isn't there? Arkavi says that even though pulsational pair instability is the best explanation for what they've seen, supernova don't produce the amount of energy or the mix of elements observed in IPTF14HLS. In short, the explosions are way too powerful to be explained away by his model. Arkavi finishes with, quote, "Because the star has exploded several times, it may not even fit the definition of a supernova. You think of a supernova as a death of a star, and you think of death as something that only happens once. It's a very different kind of supernova that can die repeatedly. We may not even be close to correct by proposing the pulsational pair instability model, but right now, that is our best and only explanation for the phenomenon being observed. Unquote. The next story is kind of a mix of astronomy and biology and ancient history. It turns out that the asteroid collision that may have doomed the dinosaurs 66 million years ago really stank. Well, in more ways than one. Dr. Natalia Artemieva of the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson reports October 31st in Geophysical Research Letters that a new analysis of gases released from vaporized rocks at the impact site in modern-day Mexico suggests that the smash-up released up to 3 times more smelly, climate-cooling sulfur than anyone previously believed. The Chicxulub impact spewed about 325 billion tons of sulfur and 425 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air. This relatively modest release of CO2 might have contributed to long-term planetary warming, but the massive cloud of sulfurous gas would have more immediately blocked out the sun, researchers suggest, plunging the planet into a dark Narnia-style winter that was colder and longer than previously thought, and in which it was never Christmas. That can explain why so many of the Earth's plants and animals went extinct around that time, even those living nowhere near the impact crater. The new study suggests that the impact may have released around 3 times as much sulfur and much less carbon dioxide compared with previous estimates from maybe 20 years ago. The new calculations incorporate a better understanding of the meteor's angle of impact, the composition of the rocks, and how much gas would make it high enough into the atmosphere to influence climate. Next story. Indiana Jones, eat your heart out, man. We now have equipment that can see into ancient structures without triggering giant boulders trying to kill us. So this next story came out in the November 2nd issue of the journal Nature. Dr. Kurihiro Morishima of Nagoya University and his team used high-tech devices, typically reserved for particle physics experiments, to peer through the thick stone of the largest pyramid in Egypt for traces of cosmic rays. And what did they find? They found a previously unknown empty space, which probably does not hold the Ark of the Covenant, but then again, who knows? The mysterious cavity is the first major structure discovered inside the roughly 4,500-year-old Great Pyramid since the 19th century. Morishima says, quote, "This is a significant historical finding, and even though there is currently no information about the role of this void, these findings show how modern particle physics can shed new light on the world's archaeological heritage," unquote. The open space may comprise one or more rooms or corridors, but the particle detector images reveal only the rough size of the void, no detail of its design. Morishima and his group probe the Great Pyramid's interior with devices that sense muons. Muons, getting back to space and sounding like something else made up by Star Trek, are the byproducts of spacefaring subatomic particles called cosmic rays striking atoms in the atmosphere. Muons continuously rain down on the Earth at nearly the speed of light. But while the subatomic particles easily streak through open air, rock can absorb or deflect them. By placing detectors near the base and areas deep inside the Great Pyramid, and measuring the number of muons that reach the detectors from different angles and directions, scientists could spot empty spaces inside the ancient edifice. For instance, if a detector inside the pyramid picked up slightly more muons from the north than the south, that would indicate that there was slightly less rock on the north side to intercept the incoming muons. That relative abundance of muons could indicate the presence of a chamber in that direction. The newly identified void was first seen with a type of muon detector called nuclear emulsion film, which Morishima's group laid out in a space called the Queen's Chamber and the adjacent corridor inside the pyramid. When muons zip through these films, the particles' chemical interactions with the material leave silver trails that can reveal which direction the particles came from, a little like X-ray films work. Upon developing the films, the researchers saw a surprising excess of muons coming through a region above the Grand Gallery, a sloping corridor that runs north-south through the center of the pyramid. The cavity appears to be at least 30 meters across, which is about the size of the Grand Gallery itself, so we're not talking small here. Morishima and colleagues confirmed their discovery with observations from two other types of muon detectors that generate electrical signals when muons pass through them. Morishima says he hopes their findings will pave the way for muon imaging of other ancient monuments around the world, particularly at archaeological sites where traditional excavation may be difficult, like deep in the jungle or on mountainsides. So our next story is pure biology, and it came from last month's Journal of Experimental Biology. It concerns those sad goldfish that people keep in ponds in their backyards. The poor things are usually left out all winter to fend for themselves, because that is what people have been doing since they started keeping koi thousands of years ago. Well, koi, the fancy name, or goldfish, the common name, are all the same species, which is carp. We should probably respect carp a bit more than this little song refrain suggests. Here's a little lyric by Robbie Schaefer to show you what I mean.
A carp is a fish that will eat anything just as long as that thing is edible. It will even eat things such as dirt, mud, and trash, and it thinks that these things taste incredible. A carp is a fish that will eat anything, and by now you must know what I mean. If you ever meet a carp and you take him to your house, make sure that he's really, really clean.
But, at any rate, carps deserve respect because they can do something lots of other organisms can't, and that is recover from serious brain damage brought about by anoxia. At first glance, the elegant Crucian carp is capable of surviving for months without oxygen, emerging apparently unscathed from icy lakes and puddles at the end of winter when the sun returns. But Dr. Johnny Lefebvre and her colleagues from the University of Oslo, Norway, weren't so sure. They wondered if this remarkable, robust fish suffered brain damage as a result of oxygen deprivation and the subsequent return to oxygen. Intrigued by the possibility, Lefebvre went fishing in a small lake near Oslo to collect carp before exposing them to a mini winter followed by spring in the lab by supplying them with deoxygenated water for 1 week before turning the air back on for a day. Checking for signs of cell death in the fish's brain, the team was impressed to see that the cell death rate was unaffected while no oxygen was available. However, as soon as the oxygen returned, the brain cell death rate more than doubled. And when the team checked to find out how the cells were dying, there was no evidence of the programmed form of cell death, apoptosis, that naturally tidies away defunct cells, suggesting that the brain cells might be dying through other, more destructive or unconventional means. However, when the team tested for signs of cell growth, one day after the oxygen returned, neither the fish in the oxygen-rich water nor those in the oxygen-poor water seemed to be rebuilding their brains, although Lefebvre points out that recovery may occur later. As the oxygen levels in the lakes vary naturally over the seasons, the team collected fish when the lake oxygen levels were highest in summer and early autumn, and at their lowest in the late autumn and winter, and checked for signs of brain cell death. Interestingly, the winter fish showed relatively low levels of brain cell death, while the summer and early autumn fish were losing brain cells at a higher rate. Having discovered that the fish experience serious levels of brain damage through cell death when the oxygen returns in the spring, the team tested how the damage affected the fish's memory. After training small groups of fish to navigate a maze in return for a food reward, the team plunged the fish into a brief simulated winter followed by a day of spring. Despite experiencing brain damage, Following the return of the oxygen, the fish were able to reach the food reward at the end of the maze as fast as they had before the simulated winter. However, their memories were poor, and they did take wrong turns. When the scientists tested the ability of brain-damaged fish to learn how to navigate the maze, they found that the animals picked up the task quickly. Lefevre says, quote, "They were able to repair any brain damage caused by anoxia and reoxygenation," unquote. All right, last story of the night. We can certainly quantify the fastest animals on Earth. But why are they the fastest? Why is the cheetah faster than a lion? That's not a question that we really ask very often. Well, Dr. Miriam Hirt from the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research and her team did ask that question, and they tried to answer it in the latest issue of the journal Nature Ecology and Evolution. Some animals that you would think would be faster than others simply aren't. Are there physical reasons for this? Hirt points out that if you ask somebody, why are cheetahs the fastest animals, you might receive some sort of quizzical looks and uncertain shoulder shrugs. And until recently, most scientists also felt that way. The largest animals should be able to move the fastest because they have more muscle to propel them at top speed, well, at least in theory. Why then are the largest animals, think elephants, outpaced by mid-sized animals like cheetahs? And this conundrum apparently doesn't just hold for land-running animals, but also for those that swim and fly. It appears that being mid-sized really is the sweet spot for moving fast. Hirt's team looked at whether the muscles that power movement may actually slow down the largest animals. And the researchers focused on fast twitch muscle fibers, which animals use when pulling off their fastest performance. Though this type of muscle helps speedsters, yes, also like the Flash, move quickly, fast-twitched fibers consume energy stores more quickly than they can be replaced, eventually leading to fatigue. The heavier an animal is, the longer it will take to reach its fastest speed, and the more energy it will require to reach that speed. Hirt and colleagues predicted that the biggest animals never reach their true top speed because they burn up their fuel supplies before attaining their fastest pace. Using the prediction that larger animals would tire out before hitting their potential top speed, the researchers modeled the maximum speed that animals could obtain based on their body mass and their mode of locomotion, that is, whether they traveled on land, in water, or in the air. Hirt's new muscle-based model was incredibly precise and predicted top speeds with about 90% accuracy in 474 different species that the team tested. Impressively, the model was accurate for animals on a huge differential scale, as small as a mite, which weighs 30 micrograms, to an animal as big as a blue whale, which is 108,000 kilograms. On land, underwater, and in the air, Hirt and his colleagues' model showed that mid-sized animals always outpace their larger counterparts. The researchers suggest that mid-sized animals have enough heft and power to move fast, but not so much that they're held back. One really cool and exciting application for an all-encompassing muscle model like Hirt's is that researchers can use it to estimate speeds for long extinct species. Like, wait for it, yes, dinosaurs! How fast could they move? Well, Hirt, using her model, predicted the top speed for six different dinosaur species. The model showed that a nimble mid-sized velociraptor would have moved twice as fast as a massive Tyrannosaurus at their fastest paces. And that confirms the expectations of previous researchers who thought Tyrannosauruses might be a little slow. Hirt finishes with, quote, "Our team's research also has exciting applications for currently living animals. It could be a valuable starting point for investigating why some animals differ from their model's prediction by being either faster or slower than expected. It will also help us to fine-tune the model and determine where our lack of understanding may lie," unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care, don't jump off that cliff with your friends. Watch out for zombie supernovas. If you're running away in your Jeep, remember, the Velociraptors will catch up with you, and the T-Rex won't. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.